You're listening to an encore presentation of Manson Mitchell from November 18th, 2023.
You understand what that dog says?
Sure, we all do.
Come on, gang. Let's split up.
Now, hold on a second there, mister. We're going after some creepy ghost person, and you want us to split up?
Well, yeah.
It's Manson Mitchell on the Weekend with Gary Manson, Suzanne Mitchell. A double shot of good conversation with great guests to power up your day. Manson Mitchell, you're on the air.
Thank you, Eric Kramer. Hi, everybody. Happy weekend. Happy Saturday to you, wherever you may be. I'm Gary Mance.
I'm Suzanne Mitchell.
Together, we are Manson Mitchell in your ears for the hour. And we get, once again, the opportunity to work with tall guy Nathan. Nathan Miller, he's at the board. He's our producer. Hey.
I just thought it would be appropriate to play that again today.
Very guys and dolls. All right.
Very. I like that. I'm glad you picked that. That's great. And we will find out why in just a minute.
That's right. Exactly. So all is well, Nathan?
Yes. A little happy pre-Thanksgiving to you. And I guess you can say a happy post-Thanksgiving to me because I've actually already celebrated it. Had family in town last week and we celebrated it a week early. So we're in the middle of a couple Thanksgivings here.
Well, that's nice. Does that mean you're going to have two turkeys this year? Last weekend and this weekend?
Oh, boy. Possibly. Maybe even two food comas as well. Going to be well rested.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a lot of tryptophan.
Well, very good, Nathan. Glad you had a nice visit with your family. We've talked about the fact that you have gone to see them a couple times. It was nice for them to come out and see you.
Yeah, it's not often we get people out here, but it's always a great opportunity whenever it arises.
Yep, yep. We got a first-time person that we're going to talk to today,
excellent.
Gary.
Yes, and the book, American Ghost Stories, True Tales from All 50 States. That's a lot of coverage. It's a lot of ghosts.
It's a lot of ghosts.
This gentleman's name is Michael A. Kozlowski, and he goes by Mike. He's going to be a fast friend of ours, I have no doubt. I had the chance to speak with Mike about a week ago in setting up this interview, and I can tell he's just one of those guys who's easy to get to know.
Oh, good. And let me tell you the least you need to know about him.
Sounds good.
Michael A. Kozlowski has written a range of books, including a short horror and suspense story collection, Some Days Suck Worse. The psychological suspense novella, Above the Clouds, his post-apocalyptic John Angel horror novels, Angel of Death and Fallen Angel, and a travel memoir about his family's adventures moving to and living in Australia. Mike lives in a suburb of Detroit, Michigan. Actually, he lives in the city of Detroit, Michigan, with three spoiled dogs. He's an active member of the local art and music community and tries to be as cool as his friends. Mike is a member of the Horror Writers Association. We'll be sure to give out all of his contact information and where to get his book at the bottom of the hour break. In the meantime, for the first time on Manson Mitchell, welcome Mike Kozlowski.
Hey, well, thanks for having me. What a great introduction that was. I feel I should just stop there.
Okay.
It can only go downhill.
Thank you for listening to Manson Mitchell.
I've got to get started with this.
Yeah.
I mean, his family's adventure moving to and living in Australia. Say a bit about that, Mike.
Yeah. So my day job, I'm an automotive engineer. And some years back, would be about almost going on 20 years ago now, I decided to take a job in Australia. And my ex-wife now, but my wife at the time, and our young kids, they were 9 and 3. We decided to move over there, and you know, it was one of those things that we didn't know how it would work out, but just didn't want to pass up the opportunity. So myself, I'm the kind of guy, I do a lot of travel for work, so I do a lot of research of the countries I'm going to. I don't want to be the, you know, the dirty American traveling everywhere. So I like to know the culture and the customs and all that sort of stuff. So with Australia, it included then learning tax codes and all that, all the things to live there. So I ended up with a stack of, you know, 15 books or something that I was reading to figure out how I was going to undertake this. And I thought there should have been a book that just made it easier. So I decided to write it. And that was my first venture into writing books.
Very good. That, very good. And interesting about Australia, as Gary has pointed out more than once, there's more things that can kill you in Australia than anywhere else on planet Earth.
Yes. Yes.
Don't they call them the nasties?
Yeah, exactly. I spent probably the first month or two avoiding everything or smashing it as soon as it moved. I just figured everything was poisonous. Dogs, cats, whatever. I stayed clear of all things, small children. I had no idea. So eventually, though, you start to poke at things and to see if they're the thing that you think it is. You know, you get accustomed to it pretty quickly, really.
And what's the worst thing you ever ran into over there?
You anticipated it.
Yeah, I did. That was going to be my
question. The worst one that I got close to was a brown snake on a hike, which is one of the, not the most venomous, but one of the most aggressive venomous snakes in Australia. Probably responsible for the most poisonous bites. So we were on a hike, and that one kind of went across the trail in front of us and up a rock cliff next to us. And we maybe had a 4-foot path to go by it, to the wow. It was a snake to the left and kind of a drop off to the right. So I stood there bravely as the family went around me, as if I could somehow stop the snake from attacking. I don't know what I was thinking I was going to do, but, that was probably the worst, the scariest experience.
There will be ghosts in a moment, folks, but I do want to ask, they say when you're in Australia, check your shoes in the morning. Did you ever encounter the notorious funnel web spider?
So I have a story that'll cover both of those things. I did always check my shoes, and I always shook them out in the morning, and it got to be, probably 6 months in, and I was doing it just out of habit, and a spider actually fell out. And it wasn't a funnel web or anything, but man, did I take a moment.
Yeah.
So,
I believe it.
We did find a spider in our pool in the filter. Little known fact about funnel webs is that they create little air sacs on their bodies, and they can survive underwater for quite a long time. So you have to check your pool as well. We found one in our filter. And we lived very near to the Australian Reptile Park, which is one of the only places in Australia that milks funnel webs for the antivenom. And we had taken a visit there. They said, if you ever catch one, bring it in. And when they first said that, I thought, why do they want all these dead smashed spiders? because who's going to bring in a live one, right? But that's what they wanted. So as I said, after a few months, you kind of get used to it. And I started poking around at that spider, and me and the kids got it into a jar, and we hustle up to the American Reptile Park to, save some lives. And we gave it to the girl at the counter, who probably weighed all of 98 pounds, and she shook it out onto her hand and was letting it wander around. And said, oh, this is a lovely little wolf spider, and she was petting it and whatnot. So it wasn't the funnel web we thought, and we were rather deflated on our way back home.
But you followed the right impulse. Yes,
and I felt very brave. I thought it was, if you think it's a poisonous spider and you still... take those actions, right? That's just as good as if it was a poisonous spider.
Yeah. That's right. Psychologically and ethically, it counts. And for those who don't know, the Sydney funnel web spider is arguably the most dangerous and most aggressive spider. It's not that it doesn't want to be bothered. It's that if you mess with it, it will attack you ferociously.
Yes.
It's not a shy spider. It's like, get out of my way.
My neighbors across the road did find one in their house that they removed, but I didn't get to be part of that. So,
what's interesting too about their environmental policy. Now, you mentioned the eastern brown spider, and it's located in eastern Australia, where the main population is. And if you find one, I got one in the house. Myrtle, hand me the shovel. I'll kill it. Oh no, you don't. The laws are quite strict. You can be fined heavily for that. You're not allowed to kill those indigenous snakes. You call pest control. They can take it out someplace and release it, but you can't kill it. Not right. That's by law.
Yep. Correct.
Interesting place, Australia. I'll admire it from afar.
Yeah. How long were you there, Mike?
Just a bit over a year.
Okay.
And then
relatively short time, then.
Yeah, made some great friends, though. Can't say enough nice things about the people there. Some of them have come and visited me here. I'm I would like to go. I haven't had the chance yet, but would like to go back and visit some of them and do more of the touristy things that I didn't get a chance to do while, you know, living and working there. But
are you a native Michigander, or have you lived in a lot of places?
I am a native Michigander, and I have lived most of my life in the Dearborn, Detroit area.
Okay.
I have a place a few hours in the thumb, but have not lived out of state other than out of the country in Australia.
Interesting.
But have done a lot of traveling for work and pleasure.
Yes. So. Yeah. Well, very good. And so what got you into writing ghost and horror stories?
After coming back from Australia, I wanted to write another book. I had so much fun writing that one, and an expat site picked it up, and a few people, you know, emailed that they liked the book and that sort of thing. So, you know, it was very encouraging, and I thought, man, this was a lot of fun. And I thought, I'll write another one, but I wasn't moving anywhere else, so I had to come up with something else to write about. So they say write what you know. I don't necessarily buy that one, but write what you love, I think, is good. Yes. So I've always been a horror fan, big Stephen King fan, like many of my generation. Yes. I'm a Gen Xer, mm-hmm. so I kind of, you know, grew up with Stephen King and his whole career.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I thought, we'll go that route. Let's write some horror stories. We like to read them. We should probably be able to write them. So. Had some pretty early success with short stories and got a few things published right away, most of which were in the collection that you mentioned. Some days suck, some days suck worse, which there's not a lot of happy endings in that one, hence the the title.
Yeah, right.
But wrote a couple novels. Only in the last probably 5 years or so, just pre-pandemic, really tried to start taking it more seriously and putting more time into it, making it less of a hobby and more of a hopeful career. And then that led to meeting Roger Janik over at Visible Ink Press, and we got talking about horror stories and ghosts, and they're more of a reference sort of publisher. So kind of the true story investigative stuff is more up their alley. And I was actually writing a novel about one of the stories we'll talk about later. Was telling him about that novel and that ghost story. And he asked me if I could tell a whole bunch more of them. And he just liked the way I told it, I guess. And I said, we started talking, and what developed out of that was the idea for the American Ghost Stories, True Tales from All 50 States.
It's a beautiful book with over 100 colored photographs and drawings in it, which really amazed me as I was going through the book. I thought, what a beautiful book. If somebody
likes ghost
stories, it should be a good Christmas gift for people, you know?
Yeah, I hope so. I think everyone should have one under their tree personally. But
of course. Now, we want to give them an idea of what some of the stories are. Obviously, we are not going to tell 50 stories, and it's a nice-sized book, but we do want to cover a few of them today, and I thought we would actually start with the home team. Our show is based out of the Seattle area, and so I thought we would tell the first story about a ghost in Washington, the Rucker House in Everett. So why don't you tell a little bit about that story?
Okay, so the Rucker House, as you mentioned, Everett, Washington, around 1890, the Rucker family moved there. It was Jane, a widow, and her two sons, Wyatt and Bethel. They moved from Ohio, where Jane's husband had passed. And at the time, they made a pretty good living, good fortune, small fortune in timber and land deals, working with people like Rockefeller and sort of, you know, timber barons of the area. The boys are considered kind of the founders of the town of Everett. And, they came out of the, late downturn. There was economic downturn in the late 1800s. They came out pretty strong and, in a good position and decided to, put some of their money into a big mansion. The son Bethel, was newly married to a woman named Ruby Brown, and he wanted to build the big house for the family to live in. So they did, up on a hill overlooking Port Gardner Bay and overlooking what would become the town of Everett. 10,000 square feet, $11 million in today's money. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful home. But right away, or shortly after moving in anyway, tragedy struck. Jane, the matriarch, committed suicide. She leapt from her bedroom window. No real information on why, if there was depressive episodes, anything like that. But the sons were heartbroken. They admired their mother very much, and built an elaborate mausoleum for her in the cemetery, which had like all kinds of beautiful epitaphs and things on there for her. You know, just tragic. But actually, that mausoleum, I should mention, houses now 20 family members. I believe it is from the descendants, and the family is still lives in the area. But Jane, anyway, that's passed away since then. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Did you have a question?
I'm just saying that 20 people, that's a lot in the mausoleum. So
yeah, it was.
It's either a good sized mausoleum, or they're all cremated in urns, or
a very small family. No, very small people in stature. No, I was just kidding. it is a large mausoleum. They even moved the father's remains from Ohio up into the mausoleum. So
very good. But kind of like a first family of Everett in a way.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
And what is the family's relationship to the house filled with this, with these phenomena? I mean, how do they represent themselves to the public? Because this is now, I mean, you're publishing it now, and I'm sure it's not the first time it's been mentioned. But how does the family feel about all of this?
They're not... it's not a horrific haunting, I guess. It's not ominous. It's not, you know, a scary sort of haunting. It's just more of a presence. One of the bigger things that manifests, they hear pianos playing in the ballroom. And sometimes people claim to see Jane's spirit at the piano. Sometimes it's just hearing the piano and echoes of it in the room. I'm not sure which one would creep me out more. seeing a ghost playing it, or just seeing it playing by itself. But they also see Ruby around the house, they claim. And the current owners, they just kind of live in harmony. You know, they think that the family, you know, obviously love their home and love the area, and just want to remain, you know, a part of it.
That is fascinating. That's fascinating. Yeah, local story from Everett, Washington, where we've spent quite a bit of time
without hearing about this house.
Right. Yeah, without ever knowing about the Rucker house.
Right.
But, you know, interesting. I wonder if they've made a lot of changes on the inside, the people who are living there now.
When I was researching, they were doing a lot of restoration, trying to bring it back to sort of the original. So I think they've kept it largely original. If you are in the area, since you are close, Halloween might be a good time to go by. Trick-or-treaters still say that they hear the piano playing sometimes as they're walking up to the house. So,
you know, it's interesting you said friendly haunting, like Casper the Friendly Ghost, or, you know, some of the hauntings are very ominous, very dark, foreboding. And some hauntings are, you know, the tinkling of pianos. And right. So there are different types of hauntings in different places, which it is also interesting.
I think it's interesting, as you mentioned, that the different hauntings, but often they're all tragic in nature as they begin, you know, and it sort of seems like, how does the ghost handle it? You know, is the ghost okay? Right. You know, very often a haunting is from a suicide or a murder or a heartbreak even, you know. And that's the most common stories we hear, I think. So every once in a while, I like a sort of happy one that maybe the ghost, you know, didn't. This one, of course, it was a tragic ending for Jane, not so much for Ruby. But, you know, she just died naturally. So it's kind of nice to hear that they're just, you know, hanging out and being cool. You know?
Yeah, just hanging around the old homestead. Very good. Very good. Before we go to break, I'd like to get a second story in. And I said home team first, which is Washington. But I was also pretty curious about the story from your current home state, Michigan, the story of Minnie Quay.
I could
very well picture it, you know, kids out on the weekend around a campfire, and go ahead and tell what happened next to a couple.
Okay, so young woman, as you said, out with her friends at a campfire, went for a walk down the beach with her steady we'll say. This is back some years ago. And, you know, a nice walk, a nice cuddle down far from the fire, a little solitude. Maybe got a little carried away, so the young lady, you know, fought off the more lecherous advances. And as young men do, you know, got frustrated and stomped off, leaving her there in the dark. So as she was making her way back to the campfire along the beach, a little chilly, you know, sun had set, of course, and the wind was coming in off the lake. The Great Lakes are, you know, large, large bodies of water. They don't really get warm, you know, very often. So that wind coming off will put a chill into your bones. But up ahead, she saw someone and she thought, oh, that must be, I must be catching up to the boyfriend, you know, so she yelled, but no response. And she thought maybe the wind, you know, was keeping her voice down, yelled again and nothing, and kind of tried to hurry up and catch up a little bit. And as she got closer, the figure moved off toward the water and actually into the water, and she couldn't understand what was happening, but she could see now that it was a young woman. And she thought maybe it was one of her friends from the fire had come looking for her, and but didn't understand why they're going in the water. And she got closer, she saw the girl out there, and the girl saw her, and they kind of stared at each other, you know, one from the beach, one from the water. And the young girl, Ruth, who was on the beach, felt this yearning to go to this girl. And she just walked into the water. She could feel the cold water up against her legs, lapping against her knees, rising higher. And she knew she shouldn't be in the way. She knew this was a silly thing to do, but she just couldn't seem to stop herself and kept getting closer and closer. And suddenly the water was getting up to her chest and she could feel it getting tight, and she was having trouble breathing. The water was so cold. And then finally she heard a voice from behind her, and it brought her out of this trance, and it was a friend of hers on the beach. And she realized, you know, she looked, the girl in the water was gone, and, you know, she realized she's in the water up to her shoulders now, and, you know, trudging her way back and struggling to get back to shore, and finally made it. And her friend got her to the fire to warm her up. And they talked about it. What was this? And, they believe it was the ghost of Minnie Quay, who was a young lady who died in the late 1800s there. She committed suicide into the water. And now the story is that she will sometimes beckon other young women to join her in that watery grave. And this was, like I said, a tale of heartbreak, the original story. I won't go too far into that. We'll leave that for the...
No, the readers need to read the story of Minnie Quay, which is also in your book. You tell why Minnie Quay was found walking into the water, which is also a very interesting part of the story.
Yeah, I think in all the stories I try really hard, and for me, I find it even more interesting sometimes, is the history of the ghost story. Why is the ghost story there, right? I mean, we all, you know, sometimes the ghost part isn't all that incredible. In most of these stories, you know, of course, we picked the lascivious ones, but you know, sometimes it's just orbs or, you know, temperature drops or things like that. You know, I'm sure a lot of the listeners have watched all those, you know, ghost hunting shows and things like that, you know, and there's never, you know, a spectral spirit walking through camera, you know. But the story of why they think places are haunted, or what tragedy or, you know, event led to the haunting, is, for me, often the best part of the story.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Why? What? Where did that ghost come from? Why is it there? That is an interesting part of it. So you always include that background. You've got, this is what's happened today, and this is why there is a ghost there and what happened to them. And I think that was a good story too. I like that.
Ruth in that story is, I may have embellished a few of the details in the story when, you know, when you read it, a little bit of artistic license, but Ruth is my mother. And, we have property in Forester, Michigan, where this story and this legend exist, and I have had property there my whole life. My ma grew up there, clearly from the story. So it's one that's very intimate to us, you know, not just because it's in my home state, but, you know, kind of have firsthand experience. So.
Well, it's funny that you should say that, because after we come back from the break, we're going to tell a story from the Chicago area, which is where I'm from. And I also have a connection to that story, and that was one of the reasons that I said I wanted to talk about that today. So you've got a family connection with Forester, and I have a family connection with Chicago, and
fantastic.
We can see how we're tied into that.
The book is called American Ghost Stories, True Tales from All 50 States. Michael A. Kozlowski is the author, Mike for short. We're sure happy that he's with us for this hour, and we're going to have more ghostly tales for you on the other side of a short break. We are Manson Mitchell. Stick with us. Glad you tuned in.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Manson Mitchell from November 18th, 2023.
Hi, everybody. This is Anson Williams from Happy Days, and I'm so excited to tell you about American Road. It is the best car travel magazine in the world. They have the most fantastic adventures detailed in each magazine with all your itinerary. We could just jump in the car with your family and have the most fabulous adventures you've ever had in your life. Please, get a copy of American Road and start your own adventure.
Staying connected with Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell is easy. Just go to mansonmitchell.com for the latest info on topics and guests. Friend Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell on their Facebook pages and like the Manson Mitchell Show page at facebook.com/mansonmitchell. If you're on Twitter, share a follow with Gary and Suzanne at Mance Mitchell. Join Gary and Suzanne Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. for an unusual show that covers everything from personal growth to the paranormal.
Here's an amazing act. Here's a tremendous act. Here's a startling act. The amazing, the thrilling, the greatest, spectacular, incredible, exciting, wonderful, world fame, most unusual novelty act.
The home of the A-Team of Alternative Talk is mansonmitchell.com. Heard right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM or streaming live from your computer anywhere.
Terry Loving wants to help you with your online marketing challenges right now. She has several courses she is giving away to help you get your business working for you online. Yes, giving away. WordPress websites are her specialty, yet her technical skills go way beyond that. Check out her blog at terryloving.com or email her directly at terry@terryloving.com. That's terry@terryloving.com.
On Friday, Manson Mitchell welcomed Daniel Bruce Levin for another conversation about applying the power of love to the complex mosaic of your life.
On Saturday, Lauren Archer talks about the distinction between mindfulness and self-hypnosis and how you can use both to best advantage for a happier, healthier life.
Bringing you mastery and mystery since 2007.
We are Manson Mitchell, Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Real people, real life, real radio. Alternative Talk, 1150.
Welcome back to Manson Mitchell, and our guest this hour, Michael A. Kozlowski, who has written several books. The one I'm holding in my hand is American Ghost Stories, True Tales from All 50 States. Michael, you were talking earlier about writing your first book when you were just either in or leaving Australia, but you have written several things. And so I'd like you to let our listeners know what you've written, if you've got a website or social media or any way that they can learn more about you and connect.
Absolutely. Yeah, so you mentioned American Ghost Stories, which is one that's out right now, came out in September, doing well, but everybody should run and buy that one. You can find it on Amazon. You can hunt me down, send me emails. I'll get you a signed copy. we can make arrangements. You can find me on my website at www.mikekozlowski.com. M-I-K-E-K-O-Z-L-O-W-S-K-I. There you'll find my shop, which has all of my books, many which you can find on Amazon, but you can also find specials on the website. You can find things that are out of print, not available on Amazon anymore, such as the travel book, the Australia book. You can be found there. We have a comic that was part of the John Angel series. The John Angel series, two books out on that. Those are Angel of Death and Fallen Angel. That series I like to call Jason Bourne meets zombies. It's very much a spy thriller sort of book set in a post zombie apocalypse time when the zombies have sort of integrated and are living with humans. It's not just zombie war. Although there's still some nefarious things going on. Jason Bourne meets zombies. Think everybody will love it. And it has a good bit of little humor and whatnot in it. I also have my short story collection, which you mentioned, Some Days Suck, Some Days Suck Worse. A pretty good helping of stories there. Also includes the novella Above the Clouds in that collection. I think there's 25 stories, all of which have been published elsewhere in magazines and webzines and things like that. I think those are the two best places to find me, for sale is the website and Amazon. And then, to connect with me from the website, you can find all my social medias, Instagram, Facebook. I'm no longer on formerly Twitter, but, what else am I on? Anyway, you can find them all there. Almost Michael anywhere. A. Kozlowski or yeah. M.A. Kozlowski is usually the tag. Easiest through the website, probably.
Yeah. I was on your website, but before I got on the website, when I just put your name in the bar, there were a lot of Michael Kozlowskis. I thought I wouldn't have thought that would be a common name, but it is.
Kozlowski's reasonably common. It's almost like Smith in Polish, or some variation thereof, you know, Kowalski, Kozlowski, you know, so, yeah. So it's reasonably common. I didn't think there'd be as many Michael Kozlowskis writing. There's one that writes a lot of tech books. So, I typically use the A anyway in my professional work. So, it helped, help distinguish, but yeah, I was a little surprised how many pop up. There was also a Miami's Dolphin lineman back in the 70s. I just used to get kidded by an older gentleman every time I saw him. He'd say, "How'd you guys play today?" Because it was the same.
Well, very good. Very good. All right. So it sounds like you're pretty easy to find. And Mike Kozlowski, .com. Is that
yes,
.com?
.com.
That's the best place to start or, you know, just look at all those other Michael Kozlowski and find the one that's writing about horror stories.
Yes. And Mike at MikeKozlowski.com is my email. I'm always happy to answer emails and go ahead and spam me. I don't mind.
Now, it seemed as though the American ghost stories were stories that existed. And then when you're writing other stories, are they coming out of your imagination or are they all researched the way American ghost stories was?
There's certainly research and elements in them true to life. But yeah, everything else is fiction.
Okay. So that then I've written kind of expand on what it is that you've heard. In the stories that you wrote for yourself.
It's pretty pure fiction. I mean, it's pretty much, you know, Stephen King kind of stuff.
Right.
Straight horror fiction, suspense. This is my first sort of, I don't know if you want to call it true tales, you know, sort of book.
No, you said true tales. It's right on the book. So.
I know. I never know how to describe ghost stories. You know, I come at everything. I probably should have put out front as a skeptic. So, I want to be convinced, and that's my search of the ghost stories. Yeah.
And I think that's a good approach, Mike, because it's important if you're going to be an author and when the subtitle is True Tales from All 50 States, it's a matter of qualifying stories, vetting stories. When you look at these tales or when you hear about them, what are your standards for deciding what will and will not be included in such a book as you've written with American Ghost Stories?
Well, the very first is interest. I want it to grab me. I want to be interested in the story and in the research and be excited about writing about it. So that's number one. And that probably comes from, you know, the fiction background. Number two, obviously, locations. I like to try to mix up, the different types of stories. I'll tell you, I could have wrote 50 woman in white stories, you know, one for every state. I could have wrote 50 haunted, hospitals, 50 haunted prisons, 50 lighthouses. Well, there's not a lighthouse in every state, but you know what I mean. Every lighthouse, every, you know, all of them are haunted or have a haunted story. So, you know, you look for ones that seem a bit more legitimate. And although I'm a skeptic, you know, calling it true stories, I don't have a problem with that at all, because I would never dismiss anybody's experience. You know, even though I might not have had that experience or even necessarily believe that experience, I wouldn't dismiss that experience, you know, and it may be, you know, a scientific explanation. It may be some simple, you know, play of light, or it may be ghosts. I don't know. I can't tell you there's not ghosts, or there are ghosts for sure. And I would never, you know, dismiss anybody else's opinion of that. So it's, you know, kind of a journey I like to take with the reader, I hope, in trying to investigate these things.
I was curious enough before we started the show to want to ask you if you've actually seen a ghost yourself.
I have not. I have had experiences that in the moment, you know, seems supernatural. And, you know, it could be they could have been, and my mind just, you know, works out a rational solution after the fact. I would say those are few and far between even at that. You know, I can remember as a kid thinking we saw an orb go down the street, you know, that later it was probably headlights, you know, from the nearby road or something. You know, and that sort of thing, but, you know, not a lot of experiences for me. So, but I've been scared plenty.
Yes. I want to go ahead and get in at least one more, maybe two more of the stories. And the one that I talked about before the break was the one from my home state, Illinois. And it's a tale from the Congress Hotel in Chicago, which I have a family connection to, but I wanted you to tell the story first.
Okay, I'll try to tell it briefly because I want to get to your story.
Mine is short.
Okay. So Chicago, as a native Detroiter, I should, you know, hate all things Chicago. It's in our DNA, but I actually quite like the city, and I go there a couple times a year. Very walkable, lovely city since they rebuilt it from the fire. They do a great job. Great city planning there. The Congress was built 1893. It was the premier hotel at the time. Hosted presidents and you know, dignitaries. However, it is littered with horror stories. I mean, just crazy. So a lot of them mob related murders and things like that. The Congress was Al Capone's Chicago headquarters, put that in air quotes, Chicago headquarters. So him and a lot of his, henchmen would stay there, take up floors at a time. So a lot of, you know, obviously you would understand a lot of, nefarious actions there with the mob and murders and whatnot. There was a connection to H.H. Holmes, who's the, widely recognized as the first serial killer in America. And he would pull victims from the hotel, either from the hotel bar or the lobby. The hotel opened right around the same time as a large World Fair exposition was going on. Elevators in the hotel are apparently very dangerous. There's at least three or four different incidences of somebody falling down an elevator shaft and dying, one by suicide, a few others accidental, apparently. Lots and lots of suicides in the hotel. There are two infamous rooms in the hotel. Room 441, which actually I mentioned Stephen King earlier. His short story 1408 is based on that room, as far as being haunted and the amount of experiences. More calls to security from that room than any others. Some of the things that happen there, people will wake up and see a dark figure at the end of their bed, a woman kicking the bed, objects moving, strange noises. The other room, 1252, is such a horrifying incident there that they actually have sealed that room off. You can't stay in that room. It exists, but they've removed the doorknob even, as I understand it. So, in this room, back in 1939, I believe it is. I might be off of a hair. A woman, Adele, Lager moved in, committed suicide from the room. So Adele had been in the family. They were in the country, rather, fleeing from Czechoslovakia. 1939, about right. Her husband, her two sons, Carol and Jan, who were 6 and 8. They had come to Chicago because Adele had some family there, so they could be close to family, have some support. They were living in a basement apartment. They had actually were quite well off in Czechoslovakia, but basically, you know, abandon that fortune to, you know, fleeing for their lives. So they're trying to get back on their feet. And Adele's husband was, you know, out trying to make business deals. He was trying to get something going in Canada. They were having a lot of trouble because they were on like a refugee status, you know, visa type situation. So they couldn't do a lot of things. They didn't have any standing really in either country. So anyway, he was out working deals, you know, was going to be back in a few days. She's staying home with the kids. Days turn into weeks. Adele had previously had some depressive issues. She had mentioned suicide, you know, before to her husband. This came out after the fact. So clearly she had some mental problems that manifested in a fear that her husband had abandoned her and the children. So on one day she took the kids to the zoo, leaving the basement apartment. And after the zoo, they checked into room in the Congress Hotel on the 12th floor. She walked to the window, took both her children in her arms, and leapt to the street, Michigan Avenue. All three die. One of the most tragic ghost stories in the book, and the child, one of the children, it was reported, Carol, his body, for unknown reasons, never even made it to the morgue. So now one of the things that people see often is a small child running through the halls, often just mischievous, knocking on doors, playing games. But also they've seen this child just vanish in front of them. So, yeah, just a tragic, tragic story there, but, a ton of incidents in that hotel. It's just
a
so
big
many
hotel too.
Yeah. Very large. I think it ended up at 15 stories when they
and something remodeled. Like how many hundreds of rooms?
You got me caught out. I can't remember exactly,
but it's like over 800 rooms,
something
in
like that.
Hotel.
Yeah,
it is a huge, huge hotel.
Yes.
Really, really big. Well, I'll tell you my connection to that. And that is I have a great aunt who was born, right around, and I'm going to guess 1911.
Okay.
And so in the 1930s, she would have been in her 20s. And when she finished high school in Southern Illinois, she moved north, stayed with my grandmother, and got a job at the Congress Hotel. She may have been a housekeeper. I'm not sure. But she worked there. And she and one of the managers of the hotel fell in love and got married. It was her first husband who was a manager of the Congress Hotel.
Oh, my.
And one day when the water heater was going on the fritz or not working or there was some question about it, he went down into the basement. Now, imagine the size of the water heaters that are serving an 800-plus room hotel. And when he went down there, the water heater blew up and killed him.
Oh, my.
And so that was my family.
I didn't even come across that story. You know, yeah. It's so many tragic things. Like, you can't even find them all.
I was wondering when I read your story if I was going to find my great uncle by marriage in there somewhere. But
well,
nothing about the busted water heater. But she
I'll have to find it in addition to. We'll add it in.
And she would have been working there during the 1930s when there was a lot of, you know, crime going on in the city. And this is right down on Michigan Avenue on the main drag of Chicago. And Interesting. There's my family connection to the Congress Hotel. That is interesting.
She probably would have been there during that that suicide event. It's late 30s.
She may very well have been. She never told me about it, but she herself had a very, very interesting, colorful life. So
that
it didn't come up.
That story is a particularly good one. There's some clippings in the book from the actual news reports and stuff of the incident. So yeah. It's nice when you find that really, you know, solid historical connection to, you know, that, you know, at least the story that's being told about why ghosts are there is an actual, you know, verifiable.
Well, yes. And the fact that they not only sealed the room, but took the door handle.
I know. It's like crazy.
No one is going in this room.
Right.
Wow. There are plenty of other rooms to rent over there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's been, it merged with a PICK. PICK, so it's now the PICK Congress Hotel.
Okay, I didn't even notice when we were there.
I don't know when that occurred, but it would have been mid-century.
Yeah.
Okay. when they had a merger, and it's still in existence. And you know,
yeah, I'm pretty sure the sign just says Congress on it. I might say Congress Plaza. Huh? Yeah, I was just okay. I go probably at least once a year. I go visit Chicago. Or, yeah.
Okay. Well, very good. Very good.
I want to hear about the Loretta Lynn Ranch.
Let's talk that before we close out the show.
Sounds good. So Loretta Lynn Ranch is in Hurricane Mills, Tennessee. And actually the ranch is kind of the remnants of that town that was built late 1800s, 1900s. A lot of ghosts from that era, late 1800s, 1900s. A lot of tragedy then. But the Lynn family bought that property in the 60s. And I didn't know this until I started researching the book, how into the paranormal and the psychic and that sort of thing that Loretta Lynn was. And, it was very interesting. I mean, I knew her music, fan, but, that was a surprise for me. So when they bought the house right away, though, they had a lot of, incidents, a lot of, seeing things. Her daughters were seeing, soldiers, come to find out later that the site had been a Civil War battle had occurred there. It had also been a field hospital for a while. And I think there was known to be 16 Confederate soldiers buried on the property. And who knows how many others may have been. So they'd see these spirits walking around. Apparently not all that worried about it right away. You know, I guess, Loretta Lynn being kind of a paranormal, person was, happy to let them be. One of the more, personal events that happened to them, or, physical event actually, was her oldest son came home one night. Her son Jack, he'd been out drinking. He fell asleep in what's known as the Brown Room now. Fell asleep with his clothes on. Wakes up middle of the night with somebody tugging at his boot. And he's kicking, leave me alone. And looks and sees a Confederate soldier just tugging at his boot. And his dog is on the bed with him barking at this apparition. His dog Mickey, who then lunges at the soldier but goes right through him. So Jack gets up, runs from the room. And both boys refused to sleep in the room after that, as you might imagine. So that was one of the more hands-on, we'll call it, experiences that they had. The two twin daughters of Loretta Lynn would see a woman in a white dress, old-timey dress. They would see the soldiers, as I mentioned, and one in particular that seemed to be recurring. So Lynn had a seance. Organized a seance, and what they discovered was that the family that had first had the kind of founded Hurricane Mills was a man named James Anderson and his wife Beulah, and that's apparently who was walking around. At one point, Loretta brought in Kim Russo, who was a fairly popular psychic, did some shows. There's actually a show, I think this is season 3 of Celebrity Ghost Stories, you can find on YouTube, is the Loretta Lynn investigation on that ranch. But she brought her in. She said these spirits are here. They're having trouble leaving. Don't want to cross over. They're afraid, connected to the property, whatever the case, but they weren't there to be malicious. They were there kind of as protectors. Beulah had had lost a child, and Mr. Brousseau had said that that was something that was keeping her tied to the property as well. Tragically, Loretta Lynn would share that grief. Her son Jack, who I mentioned previously, perished in the river, trying to cross the river on a horse on the property, and drowned. She found out about that while she was on tour. Actually, in hospital, recovering from exhaustion while she was on tour. Wow. That became then tied her to the property as well. But she never was she was never afraid of the spirits. She kind of worked with them, coexisted. She said that she felt all the spirits were didn't intend any harm. They most of the spirits that were there or that are seen there are people that died in the house. Actually, while I was writing this story or this book, Loretta Lynn passed away 2022.
Yes.
In her bed at the home. So, hopefully, she's walking around her home with the spirits and communicating even better, right?
So. Yes. It may be that she's actually stayed there since she passed away there. And that was one of her favorite places. So interesting to think she's now with all the other ghosts at the Loretta Lynn Ranch.
Yeah.
It puts me in mind of the show that's so popular on CBS, Ghosts, there, which was inspired by a show called Ghosts in the UK.
I like the British one much better.
So we saw a couple of episodes the other night. It's this idea of attachment to place. What feels yes. like home, you don't want to leave, even though you're not in the body anymore. I find that fascinating.
And I think a lot of hauntings seem to be, it's rarely attachment to a person. It always it's more often attachment to a place, because of whatever tragic event happened, whether it's, a residual haunting, which is, more of a loop tape running, you just see some right. action, maybe that's right. an energy or something that was imprinted in that space.
Right.
However, you would explain it, but very often I think connected, to the space. It's just such a big, those tragic events, I guess that's why they are the things that cause hauntings, or that we would expect to cause hauntings, because they're so impactful and there's so much energy imprinted from an event like that.
Yes, if somebody is just kind of slipping away, it's one thing to make an easy exit into the spirit world and, here one minute and gone the next. But when you're looking at something that is extremely traumatic, like, jumping out of a window or getting killed or something in that spot unexpectedly, I could see where the energy really doesn't know where to go or what to do and is trying to resolve things in their own minds.
Right. And then the other, I think most common would be, the heartbreak or the, love lost or, that tie to a particular individual, and then they, yes. that, often, like the white woman stories is a bride whose, husband yeah. perished and then she committed suicide or something and is still right. looking for her true love, for eternity.
Yes. Yeah. A connection for all eternity. Very, very interesting. I want to make sure that we give out the title of the book one more time. American Ghost Stories, True Tales from All 50 States. Michael A. Kozlowski is the author. And I want to say that it is not only a fascinating book for people who love ghost stories, but it's an incredibly beautiful book with color photographs and color pictures in there. So if you've got somebody who likes that, I would seriously think about that as a really nice Christmas gift.
And in our waning moments, I just want to note, Mike, that it fascinates me that down through the centuries, millennia really, ghosts persist as either a figment of the human imagination or phenomena that we don't completely understand, but it has a grip on the human consciousness, no matter where you are or what time in history.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the need in us to explain things, right? We want to know what happens when we're not here anymore. So, you know, the idea of a spirit or a ghost, you know, we can't understand that our consciousness would just stop. So something has to happen. And if it doesn't go to, you know, a heaven or a hell or whatever your particular belief may be, you know, is it just wandering the world? And, I mean, and like you said, all through history, as far back as, you know, 60,000 years BC, we have signs of funeral rites, you know, so you only do funeral rites if you think something is happening with that body after the fact, right? Or that spirit or, you know, so as far back as then, people were, you know, thinking about ghosts.
Well, this was a fun interview with good stuff. So I'm glad you joined us today, Mike.
Good to get to know you, Mike, and let's do this again.
Absolutely. I'd love to. Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Okay. We'll do this all again next weekend, maybe.
Absolutely. We hope you have a great weekend and a great Thanksgiving week ahead, everyone.
Here's what's coming up next week on Manson Mitchell.
On Friday, Manson Mitchell welcomed Daniel Bruce Levin for another conversation about applying the power of love to the complex mosaic of your life.
On Saturday, Lauren Archer talks about the distinction between mindfulness and self-hypnosis and how you can use both to best advantage for a happier, healthier life.
Bringing you mastery and mystery since 2007.
We are Manson Mitchell, Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.